Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There is a dark cloud on the horizon, if not actually almost overhead at the moment. It is a cloud that has been brought vastly closer by today's action by the United Nations, in which it endorsed a deal, I call it the Obama bomb deal, with Iran that will assuredly bring about not only nuclear weapons in that country, but probably in a number of its neighbors, with one can only imagine the horrific consequences. One of the people who has been following the United Nations, as well as these proliferation issues from North Korea to Pakistan to Iran, is our first guest. She is Claudia Rosette, one of the great investigative reporters of our time, along with the Wall Street Journal, now the journalist in residence with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. You can also find her writings at Forbes.com and PJ Media, where she has a column as well. Claudia, a dark day, I'm afraid. But tell us a little bit about what the UN did just now.
The 15-member UN Security Council just this morning unanimously adopted a resolution that endorses the Iran nuclear deal and brings it basically into the umbrella of the UN, that now enshrines it at the UN with this Byzantine, lengthy, complex resolution, which then sort of makes official within the UN the even more Byzantine, even more lengthy, and fundamentally unworkable Iran nuclear deal that was cut with the U.S. and Germany, France, Russia, China, Britain in Vienna.
I gather there was essentially no debate, a couple of maybe pro forma statements, but no real deliberation about this deal. It sounds as though it was completely cooked and wired. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, Germany enthused. But that's basically right. It was presented as a done deal. It had been negotiated already by the permanent five members of the Security Council, the veto-wielding five plus Germany. And the Israel's ambassador stepped out afterwards to say he's not a member. Israel's not a member of the Security Council, never has been, although Venezuela currently is. But Israel's ambassador stepped out to say, and I think he's right, that this is actually a very dark day. They quote, "Today you have awarded a great prize to the most dangerous country in the world," which I think is exactly right.
Claudia, one other thing that is, I'm afraid, indisputable about this is that it has deeply undermined the constitutional process of the United States. Even the so-called Corker-Cardin bill that was fashioned as a mechanism for ensuring that Congress had some say in all of this seems to have been, you know, thrown over the side by the Obama administration in its pursuit of essentially wiring the game so that it doesn't matter what Congress does, at least with respect to many of the sanctions, international sanctions, as well as European. What do you make of that?
Oh, it's terrible. What's just happened is it's both a terrible precedent within the U.S. and bad for the world. What happened there is President Obama did an end run, having promised Congress with the compromise that produced that bill that you just described, that they would get a 60-day review period, and if the deadline was overrun as it was for breaching this deal, they would get a 60-day review period, a say in whether or not this thing should pass. Instead, as soon as the deal was announced last week in Vienna, the U.S. began circulating the draft resolution that has been approved at the UN Security Council today, and then it went to a vote and passed unanimously first thing this morning. So this now puts President Obama in a position to say, especially to Democratic members of Congress who are under huge pressure right now. In fact, I believe lead negotiator Wendy Sherman has a busy day on the Hill, I see, on the State Department schedule, while John Kerry is busy welcoming the Cuban foreign minister, but that's another front, and pressuring members of Congress to okay the deal. And what President Obama will now be able to tell them is, look, you have no backup via the UN. They're lifting sanctions. They've approved a deal that will, in phases, take the sanctions off Iran, that is going to encourage member states, in fact, Frank, to provide nuclear research and development help to Iran. It leaves Iran with access to earn hundreds of billions in oil in freely in world markets, gives it a $100 billion or so effective signing bonus in the release of its frozen funds up front, takes the arms embargo off, which is not even nuclear, it's an arms embargo, but terrorism problems, after 5 years, the missile embargo after eight, think intercontinental ballistic missiles, those can hit us. Look, the UN is highly corruptible. It's a collectivist organization in which the only member that typically has taken responsibility in years past is the United States, which is also the main bankroller of the place. In this case, we have an American administration that is using the UN to do end runs around our own elected lawmakers. So the American people never saw this draft resolution that was approved today, never actually heard it debated. It wasn't really debated at the UN. It was just passed. And there it is. And this is going to be shoved in the faces of our elected lawmakers as you better now approve this because otherwise nobody else is going to be with you. That's the role. They're being strong-armed, in other words.
With a view to short-circuiting their review and deliberations and debate as well. Again, our guest is Claudia Rosette, the journalist in residence at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. She has written extensively and brilliantly over decades on all of these issues, and I think the importance of all of that work is really being brought to the fore right now, Claudia. We need your expertise more now than ever. Specifically, you've written about how nuclear extortion was actually pioneered by Iran's partners in North Korea, and that they are now perfecting the game with the kind of negotiations and the deal that has been struck. Develop that thought a little bit for us, because it didn't end well in North Korea the last time I checked.
North Korea has nuclear weapons and is making more. And what nuclear extortion has been about is North Korea, back in the early 90s under President Clinton, threatened to start producing nuclear weapons. That brought the U.S. and other parties to the bargaining table. And in their zeal to arrive at a diplomatic, peaceful, so-called conclusion to this problem, they cut a deal, the agreed framework, which gave North Korea this whole basket of goodies in exchange for North Korea's promise that it would not pursue this nuclear weapons program. Well, North Korea did what strong men do. This is the Tony Soprano of the world nuclear set. North Korea pocketed the concessions and then went ahead with cheating on the agreement and developing nuclear weapons anyway. The U.S. under President Bush went to the table again. Again, North Korea extorted concessions. Aid, diplomatic concessions, was taken off the terrorist list, got paid to blow up what was actually a symbolic, unimportant nuclear cooling tower. We paid them, and then cheated again, walked away, pocketed the deal, and at this point has carried out three nuclear tests, is estimated by the Chinese, no less, to likely have produced something on the order of 20 nuclear warheads by next year.
Yeah. And warheads is the operative word there, because they will be fitted on ballistic missiles, and they are increasing the range of those missiles and becoming more and more of a threat by the day.
Correct. It's an extortion racket, and Iran has now played this game even better than North Korea without even having conducted a nuclear test. They have just wrested massive concessions from U.S. and other diplomats desperate to please at the bargaining table. This, when you start doing this, we've entered an age in which nuclear extortion works. Every country in the world is going to read that message, and we're going to see proliferation coming out of this on a scale that nobody who aspires to diplomatic measures to contain these things will be able to do anything about. In other words, this is a road to much worse war than anything we would have faced now.
Yeah, and this is the tragedy of the narrative that the administration is pushing, that the alternative to this is war. You will get both, unfortunately, this bad deal and war, probably thermonuclear at that. Claudia Rosette, I hope we're wrong, but I fear we're right. Thank you very much for your insights here and elsewhere, Forbes and PJ Media. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Robert Dubek. We'll talk about his insights into another war, the Vietnam War, and the efforts to commemorate it. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war, from Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to welcome, for the first time, to our microphones, a man who has rendered considerable service to our country in a number of capacities, including in uniform as an Air Force intelligence officer, both stateside and for a year in Vietnam, where, among other things, he was responsible for interrogating Viet Cong, North Vietnamese prisoners, and trying to obtain actionable intelligence from them. He went on from that to become the project director for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund, a role that brought him into the thick of the then controversial, now really highly acclaimed memorial that is now, of course, one of the most important features of the mall in Washington, D.C. He has chronicled his story about the Vietnam Memorial in a book entitled Creating the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, The Inside Story. Robert Dubek, welcome. Good to have you with us, sir. Thanks so much for your service, as I say, and for joining us to talk a little bit about it.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, it's hard to remember from the many, many years we've spent admiring and celebrating, really, the Vietnam Memorial, how controversial it was at the time that it was conceived and first designed. Give us a sense of the backstory there.
Well, it became within a hair's breadth of being blocked by the Secretary of Interior. According to the legislation that was passed to give us the land and the mall, we had to have the approval of three bodies, the Fine Arts Commission, the Planning Commission, and the Secretary of Interior. He was poised to block it, and it was only with intervention from the White House, who convinced him that we could perhaps reach a compromise.
Remind us which era this was and who these principals were.
All right. This era was, we were talking about very early in 1982, which is 33 years ago. James Watt was the Secretary of Interior.
President Reagan, of course, was in the White House.
Yes. But we had a very vociferous coalition that came together to oppose the competition-winning design. And it was led by James Webb, who's now a Democratic candidate for president, Vietnam vet himself, powerful individuals like Ross Perot. We had staff members of the Heritage Foundation. There were even some staff members on Secretary Watt's staff. And basically, they found according to their statements, they found the winning design to be basically nihilistic and a degradation of the service of the veterans.
We're visiting with Robert Dubek. He is the author of a new book entitled Creating the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, The Inside Story, and was very active as, among other things, project director for a time at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund. Of the controversy that swirled around this this now iconic memorial. So the argument was this was actually something of a testimony to our defeat in Vietnam, I guess, rather than a celebration of those who served and made the sacrifice commemorated on the wall. Is that right?
Well, yes, indeed. And, you know, at first glance, you might say their disappointment might have been understandable. I mean, rather than being a tall white tower like the Washington Monument, it receded, it was black and receded into the ground. But I felt really that the debate touched a lot of fault lines that were still active under the surface in our society. And I think the first one was whether the war was right or wrong. And the first another one was whether we were wrong to get in from the beginning or we were defeated by a domestic fifth column. And there was one that dealt with race. The designer was of Asian descent. She was a woman of Chinese descent. So some people question whether a person of Asian descent should honor, you know, design a memorial to honor veterans, many of whom died at the hands of Asians. So we were dealing with, you know, a lot of cultural fault lines. And I think probably, you know, you might say one thing. I mean, there are words I learned in this process from the architects. One is called didactic and one is called evocative. And so a lot of people were looking for something that was an object, a monument, a building that made a statement of perhaps honor and glory. And we conceived a quiet place which would be there for reflection and contemplation, contemplation of the service and contemplation of the sacrifice. So, you know, we were dealing with, and we're in a different era now. When we were 33 years ago, people, you know, automatically asked us, well, what's the statue going to look like? There was an assumption among people that there had to be a statue. And in fact, there was a big debate in the press. I mean, one of the, I think it was the National Review, called for appropriate statuary. And we had a very good supporter named James Kilpatrick with conservative credentials who said, bosh! You know, there's the city is full of statuary. It's most of it is terrible. And he went there and said this would be powerful.
But talk, Robert Dubek, about how it turns out you did, in fact, ultimately have the wall accompanied by statuary and the controversy surrounding it as well.
Well, there was a very hot meeting that was held. And when I say hot, it was held in January of 1982. It was held in the Senate hearing room. Was chaired by, heroically chaired by Senator John Warner of Virginia, who strove for some conciliation the entire time. And at that meeting, we agreed to add the realistic statue to the site of the memorial. And then there was a rear guard action when we fought a battle to scale the statue down to realistic proportions and place it on the site in a relation to the wall where the whole thing served as an integrated whole. And so we were finally able, that whole thing wasn't resolved until actually 3 months after the memorial itself was dedicated.
And I remember this was a troubled time for our country as well as, of course, those of you seeking to find a way of reconciling, including my friend Joel Swerdlow, who's also written a book on To Heal a Nation. We're talking with Robert Dubek, the author of Creating the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, The Inside Story. Robert, if I may very quickly, you have one other facet in your interesting record. You have also founded and been the former president of American Friends of the Czech Republic. We're very interested in today's struggles, and specifically ones involving our friends and allies overseas and how they regard the United States as a reliable ally or perhaps not so reliable one. Can you give us a sense of how from Central Europe we're seeing the United States these days?
Well, I believe my sense from my personal friendship with the Czech ambassador and my interaction with many Czech officials is that they believe very strongly in the NATO alliance, and they're extremely value their membership. The Czechs have sent units in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the one thing that points out, it was just a month or two ago that an American convoy, made a trip from the Baltic states through Central Europe and through the Czech Republic. And there were some people who called for demonstrations, but instead they were met by cheering crowds all along the way.
Well, it's a signal, I guess, of the desire for strong American leadership and presence in that region. I hope it will be forthcoming. Thank you for what you do to try to promote our friendship with folks there, notably in the Czech Republic, as well as your service to our country as an Air Force intelligence officer, and for this new book, Creating the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, The Inside Story. Robert Dubek, come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, our duty expert on Asia, Gordon Chang, joins us. He'll tell us about China's relationship with Iran, what it expects to have come out of this deal, and one of its other clients, North Korea. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Today, President Obama takes yet another step in his fundamental transformation of the United States. He's giving the UN Security Council the opportunity to vote on his fatally flawed Obama bomb deal with Iran before the U.S. Congress has its say. Make no mistake, this is not only a fresh affront to the Constitution, which requires that a deal such as this be considered as a treaty, which two-thirds of the Senate must approve for it to be ratified. It symbolically asserts the primacy of a world government over ours. By preempting Congress, Obama clearly intends to neuter it. The question is, will swing Democrats in the House and Senate recognize that this further and potentially terminal erosion of their institutions demands rejection of a fatally flawed accord, not supine acquiescence to it? This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at irantruth.org.
This is Frank Affney, host of Secure Freedom Radio. I wanted to encourage you to attend, if possible, and certainly to monitor a very important development on July 22nd. It will be the Stop Iran Now rally in Times Square, a rally for peace through strength, with a number of the most important individuals in our country working to defeat the Obama bomb deal. For more information about this important event, go to info@stopiranrally.org. Thanks.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign, at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word: answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here.
Do this better than any station in town.
Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Now that the June 30th deadline for a nuclear agreement with Iran has passed, Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna struggling to finalize an agreement. Listeners to this program know that the nuclear talks are deeply flawed and a bad deal is preordained. We now know one reason for this bad deal is because the Rockefeller Foundation spent millions to back a loose coalition of peace groups, think tanks, and former U.S. officials to push for a nuclear agreement with Iran. This included freelance diplomacy with Iranian officials over the past 10 years. In addition, a core member of this effort is former CIA official Paul Pillar, who wrote a 2012 article titled, "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." This explains why a bad deal with Iran will emerge from the nuclear talks. This is another reason why Congress must kill this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at our new website on the Iran talks, irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by Gordon Chang, one of the country's foremost experts on Asia, a man that the international and national media turn to for his insights and assessments, notably his column at Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com blog, also at Fox News, among many other outlets, including our own. Gordon, welcome back. Good to have you with us, as always.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, earlier today, China was among the permanent members of the UN Security Council who joined in a unanimous show of support for the Obama bomb deal, as I call it. Talk, if you would, Gordon, a little bit about the relationship between China and Iran. I have long thought that China considers Iran really a client. What has that meant in terms of these negotiations, and now what's likely to flow from that relationship going forward?
Well, China has supported the Iran nuclear program with technology, also with diplomatic support, both at the governing board of the International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as the Security Council of the United Nations. And this has been both direct and indirect. So, for instance, China has supported Pakistan's proliferation efforts, also North Korea's proliferation efforts, and China has supplied materials and technology directly, especially in the first decade of this century. Now, China sees Iran as sort of an ally because it wants influence in the Middle East, competing with Russia, and it also, of course, wants cheap hydrocarbons, oil and gas. So there is a multifaceted relationship here.
Which has presumably translated into a keen interest on China's part in getting back into Iran full force, and also, I guess, releasing some of these frozen assets that would presumably flow from the UN Security Council action a bit later this year.
Well, you know, China has missed very few opportunities to support the Iranians, either with regard to their nuclear program or with regard to their other programs. So this is something that we have seen. It goes back decades, and we're going to see this going forward. And this is one of the reasons that it made it so hard for the international community to come to consensus, because China was always there to take the side of the atomic Ayatollahs. And we got to understand the dynamics here, especially because China has been the world's massive proliferator.
It has indeed, and there's no sign that that is abating. If anything, I think it will be intensifying with or without this deal in the years to come. Gordon, one of the things that I've been intrigued by, we had conversation about this last week, is the ability of the Chinese to tell their story, often really very ill-disguised propaganda in this country, without any serious impediment. In fact, broadcast via cable on millions of boxes around the United States and households across the country. What is the counterpart access, if any, of the United States, either public media or private sector media, to markets in China? And does that asymmetrical relationship augur ill for both our understanding of China and more to the point, our ability to help effect change within it?
The key word you use there is asymmetric, because China has free access to America media outlets and cable shows, CCTV, China Central Television, or Xinhua News Agency. They all have free access to the United States. On the other hand, CNN is in China, but only in hotels, extremely restricted. And most other cable networks are not available in China at all. Radio Free Asia, Voice of America are extremely restricted in China. They do have reporters, but they don't have access to the airwaves. So this is something which we have yet to decide what to do, because we have Chinese journalists who, many of them are intelligence agents, running around the U.S., and our reporters are severely restricted with visa restrictions that have been onerous. So this is a trade issue. This is a freedom issue. We have not dealt with it. It's neither this administration or the one before it. Shame on both of them.
I guess it's speaking of the Iran deal, sort of reminiscent to the kinds of opportunities that have been missed to influence what have been disadvantageous relationships or arrangements within our relationship with these other powers, despite our vaunted negotiators' efforts. Gordon, let me ask you about another very important development in your area of interest, Asia. The Japanese government adopted important amendments to the so-called peace constitution in the past few days. What is that about? And what do you think its implications are for not only Japan, but perhaps for the region and, for that matter, for our interests?
Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been very vigorous in trying to get through the Diet, which is the national legislature, bills which would broaden the interpretation of what Japan's self-defense forces can do. And this whole issue is collective self-defense, whether the Japanese can come to the aid of the United States, for instance, when Japan itself is not attacked. And he has lost a fair amount of popularity for doing this, because the opposition to this has been widespread, but actually has been quite thin. But Abe has been very courageous in pushing Japan in a much better direction. This harkens back to one of his relatives, who is also prime minister, who at great peril to himself pushed through the Japan-U.S. Mutual Security Treaty and then had to resign. So this is a tradition in Abe's family. He deserves a lot of respect and kudos for doing what he did, because this does harm himself politically. But clearly he wants to make sure that Japan is a responsible member of the international community and is willing to stand up to its defense commitments to the United States and to others.
Does it also signal, Gordon, in your estimation, that there's going to be a more assertive Japanese military in the future that will be quite apart from its security commitments to us and others, well, standing up, for example, to the increasing aggressiveness of China.
Yes. In recent weeks, a Japanese patrol plane exercised with their Philippine counterparts in the South China Sea, far away from Japan's shores. This was important because on board the plane with the Japanese personnel were Philippine military observers. And this is important. Also, Japanese troops participated in the biennial Malabar exercises in Australia with the Australians and us. So this is an important thing for Japan because it is broadening its networks with others in the region. This is going to be good because it's going to help the United States in a very difficult exercise of trying to contain Chinese expansionism.
Well, it's not just China. Of course, as you know, Gordon, you've written the book about North Korea's aggressiveness, a nuclear showdown North Korea takes on the world. You've recently written at the Daily Beast a very troubling piece about one other capability that the North Koreans may be bringing to bear, namely biological weapons, and raise the question as to whether they may even be testing anthrax on their own people. This is an unspeakably awful regime, but that seems even unimaginable for them. Talk about that.
Yes. Yes. Well, last few weeks, North Korea's state media released photographs of Kim Jong-un, the ruler, touring a biological institute near Pyongyang. The equipment that was shown in the photographs is dual use and can be used not only for making fertilizer, but also anthrax. And clearly, the North Koreans went to great expense to obtain this material and this equipment. And so it's probably, it is certain that they are not interested in just fertilizer because they could have bought this stuff cheaply on international markets. Also, at the same time, we are going to hear the testimony of a defector who brought with him a hard drive. And he says that he has information on North Korea's testing of biological weapons on human subjects. Now, a number of defectors have said this over the course of more than decades. This guy says he actually has proof. We don't know quite yet, and there are many people who are skeptical, but clearly the North Koreans have been up to no good. I'm sure that they've been testing not only biologicals, but also chemical weapons on their citizens. And this, of course, is horrific.
It is horrific, and it is a clear signal to the rest of us. If they treat their own people that way, what do they have in mind for us? Gordon Chang, thank you so much for your time today. As always, we are grateful, as we are, for your superb writings at, among other places, The Daily Beast, and, of course, Forbes.com and Fox News. Keep it up. Come back to us again next week, if you would. Next up, former senior U.S. government official and Western Hemisphere expert Jose Cardenas on the opening of U.S. and Cuban embassies today. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined once again by Jose Cardenas, a man who has served in senior positions in the United States government, notably at the U.S. Department of State, the National Security Council, and also the U.S. Agency for International Development, where he was, among other things, the acting assistant administrator for Latin America and the Caribbean. Jose, welcome. It's always good to have you, though I must say this is a kind of Black Monday around here, and for that reason, I'm very pleased to have a chance to talk with you, but a little saddened, I must say. You must feel the same.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. It's always a pleasure to be here. I think Senator Rubio captured it quite nicely when he referred to it as Capitulation Day. Not only, of course, the the rather disgusting raising of the Cuban flag in Washington, but also, of course, the whole Iran situation as well. I think that it is a truly a sad sight when you know how much, because we all remember, of course, that you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and you know, all of, how meaningful that was, and who we are as a country, and how we were able to remain steadfast against the spread of communism for 60-70 years. And today, to see all of that just simply swept away by this administration is basically meaningless. To hoist that flag here in Washington under a brutal dictatorship that has not reformed or abated in its anti-Americanism for 55 years.
Jose, you follow very closely what's happening in Cuba and understand, I think, better than anybody probably, that there really hasn't been any indication so far that it's moderating its conduct, its domestic policies, let alone its foreign policies, as a result of us having, essentially, as you say, thrown over the side decades of policies of the United States government aimed at containing this cancer.
Exactly right, Frank. We got nothing. And in fact, just the other day, one of the Cuban spies that was a part of all this supposedly intense negotiation between the Obama administration and the Castro regime was quoted in the international press. He continues to travel around the world crowing that we did not give up one iota for the normalization of relations, for the diplomatic recognition of the Castro regime. There are innumerable apologists for the regime who are trying to convince people that there are economic opportunities now in Cuba, but and that there's political relaxation going on. But the harsh reality is that there has been no meaningful, significant change in Cuba. Any economic changes that Raul Castro has implemented are occurring on the margins of the Cuban economy. It's still fully controlled by the regime. The idea that there has been any political relaxation in Cuba is nonsense.
Yeah, talk about the ladies in white as a case in point. Who are they and what's been happening to them?
Yes, in a number of Cuban towns and cities, every Sunday, these are wives of political prisoners and those in solidarity with them dress in white and simply walk to their local church to attend mass. So this apparently is intolerable to the Castro regime, and every march is heavily monitored and controlled by state security, and that is a good day. On the bad days, the ladies, the bus arrives with the goon squads to rough them up and shove them into the bus and take them all to the local jail. And so this is a spectacle. This occurs almost every Sunday in Cuba. It has there has been no let up in the repression of Cuban dissidents and human rights activists. In fact, Frank, I would say that there has been an increase in the repression because now the regime feels that it has a respite to exact punishment against the dissidents. The regime sees this as an opportunity to basically decapitate the opposition now that they have American recognition and liberalization of the embargo. This is their time to fully consolidate control.
Yeah, this is essentially, there are now no costs to them for doing so. And as we were talking about with Claudio Rosette earlier in the program with respect to Iran, the same calculation, you can bet, is taking hold there and probably, as Gordon Chang has indicated, in a lot of other places besides Iran and Cuba. Let me ask you about one other piece of all of this normalization, Jose Cardenas. And again, Jose was the acting assistant U.S. administrator for Latin America and the Caribbean in the U.S. Agency for International Development, among other senior U.S. government positions he held a while back. And critical to all of this was the U.S. government's willingness to capitulate on the demand by Cuba that it be removed from the state sponsor of terrorism list. Jose, as this is going on, the negotiations between one of the terrorist groups that it has long sponsored, namely the FARC in Colombia, their negotiations with the government there seem to be breaking down. Is it in fact the case, as a serious observer of the hemisphere, that the Cubans have stopped supporting the FARC, or for that matter, other terrorists in our region? Or is this really just another example of capitulation day, as it were?
Exactly, Frank. It is basically part of the administration's see no evil approach to international affairs. You cannot. There is no daylight between the Castro regime and the FARC, and it remains so. The peace negotiations that you refer to are actually occurring in Havana. That is the depth of the confidence that the FARC places in the Castro regime. The peace negotiations between the Colombian government and the FARC have turned into an unmitigated disaster for the government of Juan Manuel Santos. It was a mistake to do what he did, to try to send his negotiators to Havana to negotiate supposedly peace in Colombia after 50 years. It is the same animal. The FARC and the Castro regime are inveterately dedicated to anti-Americanism, and the more room that we allow them, it will only redound to the utter harm to U.S. interests in the region and the globe.
Yeah, and that will include agencies like Hezbollah and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and Hamas that have also benefited from both Cuban support and that, of course, of some of their sponsors, notably Iran. In the closing moments we have, Jose, where do you think these negotiations between the FARC and the Colombian government are going to go from here?
Well, President Santos said last week that he will give the talks 4 more months to come to an end. These talks have been going on for more than 2 years so far, and he has paid dearly politically in Colombia for this meandering process that he began. So he is giving it 4 months. We'll have to see whether he mans up to that pledge and forces an agreement with the FARC, or else he again succumbs to further appeasement.
And kicks the count down the road, as the Obama administration has done with such devastating effect on this Iran deal. Jose, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for joining us, as always. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, marking this capitulation day on several fronts. It's deeply appreciated. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.